I'm Steve Kraske, and this is KCUR's Up to Date. In 2018, Democrats made gains with wins in state and local elections. Will that trend continue in 2020? While Democratic leaders work to build a cohesive platform, voters may have to wade through 18 possible candidates. Today, our political panel considers what will make a winning strategy for the party. What do the victories of Sharice Davids and Josh Hawley have to teach Democrats? And speaking of Davids and Hawley, we'll examine the working styles of the two congressional freshmen as well. Then we'll learn why some victims of sexual assault never choose to come forward with their story and hear tips you should know on how to recognize the signs of predatory grooming. We'll get you up to date after this hour's news. No fewer than 18 Democrats are running for the White House next year, and more may be on the way. Two candidates, including former Vice President Joe Biden, is considered likely to run, and five others are in the might-run category. I know this not because I keep track myself, but because the New York Times does, and that's how the newspaper categorized the race last week. This is seen as the largest presidential field in recent decades and perhaps the largest ever. So you wonder, how are Democrats going to sort through all of this? Will the party shift leftward and endorse Medicare for all? Or will a more moderate tone prevail? We'll take a look at the first 100 days of two political newcomers from our area as well. That's Kansas Congresswoman Sharice Davids and Missouri Senator Josh Hawley. With us to kick all this around are Beth Fanami. She's the chairwoman of the UMKC Political Science Department. Professor, nice to have you. Welcome.
Thank you.
Professor Peverell Squires, a political scientist at the University of Missouri in Columbia. Professor, nice to have you as well.
Yeah, it's good to be here.
Michael Smith is chairman of the Department of Political Science at Emporia State University. Professor Smith, welcome.
Thank you very much.
Professor Fanami, you know, there are a lot of Democrats who I think assume that President Trump won't win a second term given his poll numbers. They think whoever the Democratic candidate is will likely be the next president. What do you say about those assumptions?
I think they need to talk to voters. I think Donald Trump, his poll numbers are still quite high among Republicans. He's, you know, polling in the upper 80s, early low 90s among Republicans. He's still doing okay among independents. So I would caution such optimism at this point.
Professor Squire, what do you say?
I think obviously things are lined up well for the Democrats. But we have to wait and see. We don't even know what politics will look like tomorrow or next week, much less by the beginning of 2020. So I think Democrats have reason to be optimistic. But again, there's so much that can happen between now and Election Day in November 2020 that nobody can forecast with any certainty.
You know, Professor Smith, there are so many candidates already running for the Democratic presidential nomination. I have this theory that so many candidates are running for the same reason that so many candidates ran for Kansas City mayor in the primary. They think they can catch fire, carve out at least 15% of the vote in at least one early state to make them a major player in this race. Am I seeing that right?
I think you are seeing it right. A couple of our colleagues, John Sides and Lynn Vavrick, are political scientists that write about surge, scrutiny, and decline. You get your 15 minutes of fame. But the question is, when they start digging through your record and your personal life and throwing things at you, many of which are unfair, they could be your opponents, the news media, people on social media, how do you handle it? And what you'll be judged by is not if you've ever done bad things, but how you handle it when they start throwing it at you.
Professor Fanami, this is perhaps the largest Democratic field in history. Why is that?
You know, we had the same thing happen in 2016 with the Republicans. I think there's this perception that the president is vulnerable and that, you know, for a lot of candidates, this is their make or break moment, or at least that's how they feel. And so, you know, you want to run when you have the opportunity, and opportunities don't present themselves every presidential election year. So I think anyone who has presidential aspirations is going to throw their hat in the ring.
Professor Squire, in 2016, the Republicans had this unusually large field, too, and they wound up winning the White House. That said, to what extent are Democrats undermining their chances with such a large field?
Whenever you have a large field, obviously, there's some incentive for some participants to try to distinguish themselves by attacking others. And I think we need to point out, we get a large field like that because with each new entrant, it makes it that much easier for somebody else to decide to take the plunge because, of course, finishing in the top half may mean getting only 5 or 6% of the vote in some of the early contests. So I think what we're going to find right now is that Democrats are going to largely agree on many of the big issues that they want to talk about. And so we're going to be sort of left to sorting among personalities and characteristics and trying to think about what sort of person, in a generic sense, that the Democrats would like to put up against President Trump.
Professor Smith, the party has some big decisions to make here, though. Is it a liberal party in the mold of Bernie Sanders? Is it something more moderate in the form of former President Barack Obama? That's a pretty big call.
It's a big call. As I can see it, and I'm mostly looking at the candidates that are getting the most publicity right now, there's Bernie Sanders, and Bernie Sanders is Bernie Sanders. And with a lot of the other candidates, I think their positions on a lot of issues are pretty similar. I think the question is, what package do you want for your Democratic candidate? Do you want a young mayor from the Midwest? Do you want a prosecutor from California? Do you want something else? I suspect that if you were to nail down these candidates on most issues, except for Bernie, because he's Bernie, that they would probably agree about 90% of the time. But how do you want your Democrat packaged is the way I see it right now.
How confident are you, though, that the party will hang together as it goes through this process of figuring out, is it a liberal party, is it a moderate party?
The party will hang together right now because of a shared opposition to Donald Trump and nearly everything he represents. The question, though, is what happens when Trump's not there anymore?
Meaning
that the enemy of my enemy is my friend. But once you remove that factor, will the Democrats be able to stay on the same page to promote an agenda as opposed to focusing on opposition to a very strong personality who they have a shared dislike for?
So you're saying what might happen to the party following the 2020 election then?
2020 or 2024, however it shakes out. The cohesiveness that's generated by this urgency to fight Trump cannot outlast Trump unless there's a clear agenda that Democrats can more or less agree on.
Professor Bonamy, where do you see the party right now? Is it a liberal party, a moderate party? How do you assess it?
Well, I think it's both. And I think the big question for Democrats is how do they fashion a platform that the public can get behind? And I think one of the things to keep in mind is that the public generally thinks of itself as sort of moderate to conservative. But when pollsters ask questions about particular policies, the public tends to be reasonably moderate or center left. And I think that's what really Democrats need to focus on is the policies themselves and ignore a lot of the grand ideological discussion and focus on policy.
So I hear you saying that you agree with Professor Smith that Donald Trump will remain this unifying factor for Democrats moving forward, and maybe they're catching a big break as a result. If there was no incumbent seeking re-election, it might be a different proposition altogether.
Sure. I mean, I think it's a lot like what happened in 2010 with the Tea Party Republicans, where, you know, Obama was sort of the foil for all Republicans. And, you know, something similar is happening now with Trump, and probably even more extreme than we saw with Obama and Republicans.
Let's talk about some of these issues, Professor Squire, that likely will be the subject of much debate among Democrats in the months moving forward. About 56% of Americans, based on a poll I looked at last night, support a Medicare for All plan. Is the country ready for Medicare for All? Will that have to be part of the Democratic platform?
I think we're probably going to characterize lots of different policies under that one label, and there will be some difference among those policies. I think Democrats clearly are advantaged when they turn the conversation to health care. The Republicans have yet, after a decade, come up with anything they can offer as an alternative. But I think Democrats will probably be best advised to leave out some of the intense detail that journalists might want to push them to fill in. and probably just keep the conversation on the idea that they're going to do more to provide health care coverage to more Americans than any alternative the Republicans might offer.
But what kind of detail, Professor, might undermine Democrats, might cause them to get down in the weeds and have a big fight about it?
Well, you know, when you start thinking about Medicare and what it means and how those people in the country who are on Medicare interact with the healthcare system, it's different than those of us who are still covered by private insurance. And so I think there are just lots of questions about copays and about what gets covered and what doesn't get covered and whether you need a supplemental health insurance policy or not. All those things that people 65 and older have already had to grapple with. I'm not sure a lot of Americans who are exhausted by the healthcare debate that we've had for the last decade really want to have to think long and hard about what a replacement healthcare system might look like.
But still, you're suggesting, Professor Squire, that there are details when it comes to Medicare for All that perhaps voters might want to pay attention to as this debate moves forward.
Absolutely. Of course, we're all concerned about costs and coverage and what it means for pre-existing conditions, what role, if any, private insurance companies will have in a new system. And so I think we can't actually tell anybody what those policies would look like until we've had a long and undoubtedly drawn out debate in both chambers of Congress trying to fill in these kinds of details. So I suspect the Democrats who are running for president will talk in sort of larger terms about their goals and some of the processes they might want to achieve that. And then, as always, leave it to Congress to have to fight over the details.
If you just are joining us this morning, you're listening to Up to Date on KCUR. We're talking about the 2020 Democratic presidential race with 18 candidates in the field, that number likely to grow larger in the weeks to come. I'm visiting with Professor Beth Vonnemy from UMKC, Peverell Squire from the University of Missouri in Columbia, Michael Smith from Emporia State University. You know, Michael, what will Democrats be saying about income disparities in this country moving forward? Is that a winning issue for them?
I think it is. One of the big issues that Democrats are not talking about much publicly, and I beat this drum whenever I can. We had two voters who voted for Barack Obama in 2012 and Donald Trump in 2016 for every one that voted for Mitt Romney and Hillary Clinton. And the big question is, do Democrats try to get some of those voters back? Income disparities are a big issue with those voters. They're probably a bit more socially conservative. But that can potentially be a winning issue. Well, yes.
What's the remedy for income disparity? What types of solutions might candidates throw out there? Is it just adjusting tax tables, or is there more to it than that?
Well, the problem with getting into policy weeds is that voters' eyes tend to glaze over. That's why the Medicare for All thing is such brilliant marketing. I totally agree with Professor Squire. The implementation of a policy like that would be vastly complex and involve a lot of judgment calls and political compromises, but it just sounds so catchy. Same deal with the $15 an hour minimum wage. You can remember it, you can tweet it, and so that's going to be the balance that some of the better policies, in my opinion, for redressing things like that can get quite complex. Like you say, tax code changes and indexing things to inflation and,
right,
and all this kind of stuff. How do you package that in such a way that you can tweet it?
So when it comes to the livable wage, then, Professor Smith, a living wage might be part of that debate. We've heard that here in Kansas City for any number of months now.
Well, I think so. And I think that also keep in mind that a good deal of the Democrats' base, first of all, in 2016, the Democrats had some turnout problems. California, for example, has really low voter turnout, one of the worst. And so, yeah, they vote Democratic, but that's if they vote at all. Second of all, I don't think we in Midwesterners really appreciate the housing situation on the coasts. $600,000-$700,000 for a ranch house. Mm-hmm. That's a 45-minute to an hour commute in heavy traffic to work if you're lucky. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's almost a crisis, really, and we're kind of lucky here. We have our own challenges, of course. But I think that there are latent issues like that that could also rally the base.
Mm-hmm. Beth, is there another issue on the horizon here that you might point to that likely will become very much part of the conversation?
Well, I think the question of trade is obviously going to be on the table. I don't think trade and immigration, not necessarily a package deal, but I think they have implications for each other. But I think both of those issues are going to be on the table, just given the response of the Trump administration on those two issues and the opposition from a lot of the Democrats. And trade is one of those issues that could easily divide the Democratic Party and mm-hmm. could also turn off voters if they're not careful in terms of how they talk about, you know, protections for labor and how they talk about consumer protections. And so I think both those issues come up in the 2020 election.
Professor Squire, I should point out that we're taping this program the day that Robert Mueller's report has been released in its redacted version. The report is still being vetted by reporters across the country. But integrity in the White House, is that likely to remain an issue moving forward, given what we know about this report so far?
Oh, I'm sure the Democrats will want to keep it an issue, and I think there are enough doubts about the character of the current occupant of the White House that it will, on its own, sort of have a life. And I think that's important because, you know, as we look to the future and we try to predict what issues are going to be important, it's very hard to tell because the world will intervene in ways we don't anticipate. But personal character and the qualities of the person we put in office are the one thing that we can usually have some confidence in. And so I think the Democrats will be, among other things, looking at the people they're choosing among to try to figure out who, again, presents the best contrast to President Trump and all of the noise and problems he brings with him.
Again, we're talking about the 2020 Democratic presidential race in this segment of Up to Date. Michael Smith, which of the candidates has caught your attention so far, or which candidates, in your view, have sort of popped up above the pack in the early going here?
Well, I'm interested in Pete Buttigieg. It is interesting, too.
However you say his last name.
Well, I was just going to say we've got some interesting pronunciation issues yeah. going on here. Yeah. Amy Klobuchar is another one.
Yeah.
He certainly – I talked about the surge, scrutiny, and decline. He's definitely in the surge phase, and he's about to start the scrutiny phase.
Mm-hmm.
And I will be, you know, I don't have any reason to believe he's a bad person or done bad things, but he's human like everyone. And when things get thrown at him, maybe quoted out of context, or he's young, he's probably lived a lot of his life online. Who knows? How's he going to handle that? How's he going to adopt to it? As I said
explain
earlier.
Explain this to me. How can a mayor from South Bend, Indiana, running for president of the United States, pop his head up as effectively as he has so far? I've never seen anything like this before.
Short answer is Donald Trump rewrote the rules, and so
we don't
know what the rules are anymore.
Yeah,
I have to tell you, as a state and local guy, I am loving it. Maybe that's why I like Buttigieg so much. Is because, President Trump's not going to fill that pothole. The Mueller report is not going to get stable funding for your kids' schools or deal with that abandoned housing in your neighborhood. I've been preaching this gospel of start looking at your state and local government. I know you have too, Steve, mm-hmm. for years. And for that reason alone, that we're starting to pay attention to local government, I'm excited about this.
Beth, who's caught your attention?
Well, I agree. I think he's an interesting candidate. He also, but I think what's really interesting about him is that he's really good at responding to questions on the fly.
Yes.
And I think that's something that is going to be appealing to voters, particularly in contrast to Trump, because I don't think President Trump is as good at answering policy questions on the fly. But I think, what happens with Joe Biden is probably a really important question.
That was my next question.
Yeah, I think
In your mind he's going to run, Beth?
Well, there's still a little slight doubt, but I think he's going to. And I think that changes sort of the dynamics of the race. It, brings not just a question of character, but also a question of sort of personality to the race. Mm-hmm. And, he's a fighter. Joe Biden's a fighter. Trump's a fighter. And so to me, that's kind of a curious debate. A series of presidential debates would be to see Joe Biden and Donald Trump debate.
Yes.
But, curiosity may be not great for presidential politics, but I think, you know, that's an important question. If Biden runs, I think it changes the dynamics of the race.
Yeah, and you wonder how the mayor of South Bend, Indiana, stands shoulder to shoulder with the former vice president of the United States. I mean, that'll be an interesting contrast. Not to say that Buttigieg can't emerge, but you wonder.
Well, I think you do wonder, but I think that's part of what is appealing about him is that he has a really Midwestern stage presence where he's calm, he's collected, and he doesn't look as if he's cowering, you know? And I think that's important when you're – yeah, I mean, I wouldn't want to stand next to Joe Biden and talk about, you know, foreign policy.
Yeah. Peverill, who's stood out to you in the early going so far?
Well, let me turn it the other direction and say who I've been surprised has not done as well as I might have anticipated.
Okay.
And I'd say Klobuchar, who a lot of people think of as being one of the better moderate Democrats, who really did well when she entered the race, but has sort of dropped out of sight since. And Gillibrand, who is also, again, brings in some interesting credentials, but has yet to really demonstrate that she can bring in large sums of money or rally lots of voters on her behalf.
And well, Senator Klobuchar has just been devastated by those reports about how she's abused her members of her staff, right, Professor?
Well, that's not something you really want to have as the talking point about you. You know, she wants to focus on issues, and again, that brings up personality. And in this race, with the matchup that they're looking at, Democrats really can't afford to give up the higher ground that they really want to have when they go up against President Trump.
Peverill, can Joe Biden win this nomination, given the recent issues about accusations of inappropriate behavior towards women? He's been out of office now for 4 years. How do you see him?
Well, you know, he still polls well, and of course the polls don't mean that much right now, but he's still up on top, which is where you would prefer to be. Everybody has some idea of who he is. And he has obviously a great deal of political skills. I'm a little hesitant about whether I think he'll actually get in the race or not. I think that every day that goes by where he hasn't entered makes it a little less likely that he'll ultimately take the plunge. But if he does come in, he's going to be like Bernie on the older right side of the campaign. Unlike Bernie, he doesn't seem to have a huge groundswell of support among younger people. And so I think if you have a contrast with some of the younger Democrats, not just Buttigieg, but some of the other candidates who are still in their 40s or early 50s, I think it may be one of these sort of generational pivots that we occasionally have in American politics, and Biden might be on the losing side of that.
You know, Beth, more locally, Kansas freshman Congresswoman Charisse Davids is being praised for the low-key approach she's taken to her job with her colleagues out in Washington. Why does that approach appear to be working for her?
Well, I think it's a smart approach because the House of Representatives continues to operate on a very on two bases. First, seniority is still really important among Democrats in the House of Representatives, and I think she recognizes that, and so she's sort of trying to stay in her lane a little bit on that accord. But it also operates as very party heavy, and the party leadership in the House of the majority party still tends to dominate. It dominates the agenda, it dominates committee assignments, and so being on the right side of that discussion is important, and I think she's done that.
By being low-key and respectful to her elders, in seniority.
Right, talking, you know, keeping their interests in mind.
Michael Smith, what do you make of her start?
One of the things that I'm really interested in with the media coverage is her close relationship with Emanuel Cleaver.
Mm-hmm.
Things are really different when the 3rd District is represented by a Democrat. That culture of the border war and let's offer tax breaks to get businesses to move out of the other states and I would never live there is really different. And it looks like Congresswoman Davids and Congressman Cleaver have a pretty close working relationship, and that may mean a different approach to federal aid to Kansas City.
Professor Squire, just quickly, on the Missouri side, another freshman lawmaker, Josh Hawley, is taking a defiant approach to his job in Washington. He says he won't be bullied. Professor Squire, what do you make of that?
Well, I think he's trying to produce his own identity and to establish himself as being different from both the Republican colleagues in the Senate and to some extent from President Trump. But he has the luxury of not appearing on a ballot again until 2024. And we, of course, have no idea what the political world will look like even past 2020. So at this point, we're not sure whether he's going to want to run for reelection or if he envisions himself as the Republican nominee in 2024.
The luxuries of a six-year term, right? Yeah, something different. I want to thank our very good panel for taking some time with us today. Beth Vonnemy, chairwoman of the UMKC Political Science Department. Peverell Squire, political scientist at the University of Missouri in Columbia. Michael Smith, chair of the Department of Political Science at Emporia State University. Thank you all for a very good conversation. I appreciate it.
Thank you.
Thanks.
My pleasure.
Time for a break. When we come back, we'll talk about sexual abuse and how to spot it, particularly among young kids. I'm Steve Kraske, and you're listening to Up to Date on 89.3 KCUR. And we are back. I'm Steve Kraske. Earlier in the week, we learned a wealth of information about credit scores and the truth about how to improve yours. Hear that and other conversations at kcur.org/up-to-date. Monday on the show, diversity in sports is growing, but women rarely hold the top jobs. We'll see what females have made inroads and which doors they're still trying to open in the world of sports. That's Monday on KCUR's Up to Date. Well, the stats are enough to buckle your knees. 1 in 4 girls and 1 in 6 boys will be sexually abused before turning 18. You heard that right. 1 in 4 girls and 1 in 6 boys. The Diocese of Kansas City St. Joseph, which has been dealing with this issue for years with its priests, hired Kathy Morrison of Kansas City to build a program for leaders across the diocese focused on how to identify and report signs of suspected abuse. Two big issues that Morrison confronted: why people don't report, and when they do, why they sometimes recant what they said. Kathy Morrison deals with many of these issues in her new novel, Say Something, and she's here this morning to talk about how to spot the warning signs of sexual abuse and grooming children to be abused. Kathy Morrison, so glad you're here. Welcome.
Thank you. I'm glad to be here.
How did you get involved within this issue?
Well, when I was doing the training, I am a leadership development consultant, leadership development and team building, and I have a special focus on difficult issues. I did the work for the diocese, and the thing that surprised me is the number of people who came up to tell me their stories afterwards, and which led me then to write the book.
Yeah. How did the diocese, how did you get involved with that group?
Oh, they were looking for someone to come in and build this program.
Yeah.
So I interviewed along with some other people for it. They had a very strong focus on improving this issue for the diocese.
So you heard all these stories in the course of that work, and that's what led you to write your new book, Say Something?
Yes. What surprised me when we did the training, I presented this maybe 27 times to different churches, schools, at national conferences, and there were adults coming up to me telling me their story. Often, I was the first person people spoke with, or in some cases, people had told someone, but then they recanted because they were pressured to recant. And there were all kinds of stories, and they just sort of, they lived inside my head, and I felt that they needed to be told.
Well, this book focuses on the story of Maggie, who was abused as a little girl. She has a relationship with a guy who makes her think she could be normal after all, and then the man who abused her sort of bursts back into her life. The point of the book is a point you want to make today, which is Maggie can, in fact, say something about all that's happened to her.
Correct. You know, she's a survivor and she's built a good life for herself, and she faces a tough decision. Does she report the guy again or not? And so this story really tries to take a realistic view of what goes on in a survivor's mind and what resources are there. How do people react? And hopefully inspires and empowers people to feel that they can speak up and seek justice and wholeness.
I was going to say, one of your points here is that you want to empower survivors to speak up and do what they have to do.
Correct. And also to respect that everyone's journey is different. There are some people who, for whatever reason, don't feel that they can report, but they still have resources available to them. They can still get help from organizations such as MOXA. So I want to respect the survivor's journey, wherever that journey takes them.
I want to point out, too, that the abuse you describe in your book, Say Something, isn't graphic. And I'm wondering why you made that choice.
I think that you can get the feeling of what happens and what she has to go through emotionally without being graphic. Mm-hmm. And I don't think there was a need for that. And I want to avoid triggering survivors by being too graphic in the story.
Well, you mentioned Mox a second ago. I want to bring a second guest into our conversation now. That's Kristen Mills Trowbridge. She's a counseling coordinator for MOXA. That's the Metropolitan Organization to Counter Sexual Assault. Kristen, nice to have you too. Welcome.
Thank you. Glad to be here.
How does your organization work to empower survivors to speak up?
Absolutely. MOXA's mission is to improve the lives of those impacted by sexual abuse and assault and to prevent sexual violence in our community. And we work on the fronts of prevention, advocacy, and treatment to help survivors in the general Kansas City community address sexual violence, prevent sexual violence, and heal from sexual violence.
Now, you refer to those who have been abused as survivors and not victims, and I'm wondering why.
Absolutely. The term that we use for people who are impacted by sexual violence first and foremost is up to that person. Also, we know that when someone is a victim of a crime, that they can absolutely heal from that, that they can absolutely be stronger than before, and that they can thrive.
Yeah, I want to walk through some very practical ways for our listeners to understand what grooming is and how to recognize it and how to recognize signs of abuse among young children. First, Kristen, what is grooming? Because this is a fairly insidious aspect to all of this.
It is. Grooming is the intentional process that a perpetrator uses to form a relationship and gain the trust of the victim and those close to them for the purpose of the perpetrator being able to commit that crime of sexual abuse or assault in hopes that the victim won't tell.
So you groom first in order to abuse later, then. That's sort of the step here. How do you recognize grooming, Kathy? What would you point to?
There are different signs you look at, whether it's a young child or an older child. And in some cases, the grooming is done of the parents. So spending more time with a child than you should, more touching than you should, even if it's just lots of hugging, and it starts to prepare someone to think it's okay for kids to be touched.
And what do you do when you suspect grooming is taking place, Kristen?
When you suspect grooming may be taking place, and really I would argue even before then, I think that our job as a community is to make sexual abuse and assault speakable and to speak about it with our children and with the adults in the community as well. So if someone does experience sexual abuse or assault or see signs that that may be coming, that they feel safe to talk about it.
People have a hard time talking about that, though. What do you advise them to, in order to have those conversations?
They are tough conversations for lots of reasons, and perpetrators work hard to make them tough conversations. But what we as community members need to do is to believe people if they mention something and to never blame the victim. And actually, I think that when our community takes the onus of how to respond to survivors, that will then make it easier for survivors to come forward.
Yeah. How about recognizing suspected abuse when it involves young kids, Kathy? How do you spot that?
You can see kids having maybe inappropriate behavior, kids not wanting to be left with someone who maybe cares for them, kids saying things or having changes in behavior are some of the signs that a child might be being abused.
And there's this idea, too, that sometimes kids float a trial balloon to see if they're going to be believed here. That's an interesting idea. What is that?
So a child might say, I really don't want to go spend time with that person. They're not nice. Or they'll say something like that. They might not full out describe the abuse. But they're just trying to see if you'll believe them, to see if you'll take them seriously. And if you say to them, no, you shouldn't worry about that. You should just go and do that. Then that lessens the chance of them speaking up again and speaking up about the abuse.
But that means being really attuned to what that child is saying.
Yes, I think that's right.
Yeah. Kristen, how about how to recognize suspected abuse of preteens and teenagers? Obviously, a different category of young person here.
Sure. So it's common for a preteen or a teenager who has experienced sexual violence to show signs that something is off. Those signs can really vary person to person. But if we have that open dialogue with preteens and teens about sexual abuse and assault is never your fault, and I will always believe you, then that makes it easier for a survivor to come forward.
So to lay the groundwork first, you're saying you can't overemphasize how important that step is.
I agree. That's right.
Okay. How about reporting suspected abuse, Kathy? How to report? How does that happen? Where do people go?
So there is an 800 number where you can report abuse, and it's – Kristen, do you remember the number off the top of your head?
No, it's just the Missouri or Kansas Child Abuse Hotline.
Okay. We'll put the we'll put that number up on our website after the show today. Right. Yeah.
So that's okay. A place where you can report abuse. Also, if you can call MOXA and talk to them and talk to a counselor there or a trained professional who can help you know what the right next step to take is if you suspect abuse but you're not sure. They're a good resource.
What happens when you report? You make that phone call to MOXA, Kristen. What happens next?
Sure. So whenever someone calls MOXA, they will be greeted by someone who is warm and understanding and understands the issue of sexual violence and is ready to meet that caller wherever they're at. If that person moves forward or if the abuse gets reported to the child abuse hotline, then professionals who are trained to do that those next steps take it from there.
What is the phone number? MOXA.
Oh, MOXA's 24-hour support line is 816-531-0233.
Okay. And we have the number now for the Missouri Child Abuse and Neglect Hotline, that number 1-800-392-3738. Again, 800-392-3738. And if you've been abused, Kristen, what do you advise when it comes to finding the strength to talk about it?
I would just want people to know that if it feels like you want to talk about it, but you don't yet know how to go about that or that you have the strength for it, there are people here who will walk alongside you and help you get through the process and remember that you actually do have the strength in you all along, but someone just tried to take that, but it actually still lives in there, and someone will walk with you through that process.
Yeah. Kathy, how did you deal with this in your book, Say Something? How did you approach some of these issues in the course of writing the book?
So the heroine of the book, the main character, when she's young, she reports, and her mom convinces her to recant. And this is something that happens fairly often, that a child will report and be convinced by an adult to say, oh, no, I made a mistake. So I really wanted to capture that. And so later when she is thinking about reporting again, interestingly, she doesn't do it for herself, but because she sees another little girl is in danger.
Mm-hmm.
And I wanted to actually show what is it like when you make that phone call, because I think it's intimidating for people who've never made the call before. And I think it's important for people to understand that when you make the call, it starts a process to ensure that a child is safe. It doesn't send a SWAT team knocking on someone's door. And mm-hmm. I think some people have that impression.
Well, I think probably they do. That's exactly right. Because you really are entering a whole unfamiliar world at that point when you make that phone call.
Correct. Mm-hmm. Correct. And so when you make the call, they'll ask really for basics. They'll ask for the person that is being abused or that you suspect is being abused, their name, their address, if you have it, their age, who you think the abuser is. You have the option of being anonymous or not anonymous when you make the phone call.
And that's important.
For some people, that is very important because it takes away some of the fear of calling.
Mm-hmm.
Kristen, do you have other thoughts about that call that I've missed?
What I would want people to know about making that report is that you don't have to know, that the people answering that phone call know that you don't know, and they will step by step ask you the appropriate questions and give guidance on what to do.
Mm-hmm. But again, it can be a pretty scary moment.
Absolutely. Yeah.
If our listeners want to call in with questions about all of this, maybe we have a couple of great experts here who can help you begin to think about this process if that's where you need to be. 816-235-2888 is our phone number here. Again, 816-235-2888, or you can tweet us at KCUR up to date. In your book, Say Something, Kathy, the the parent that encourages Maggie, I think, to recant. Why did that happen? What was the motivation of that adult to want to go there?
She was afraid. She was afraid of the person who was doing the abusing. She was also physically abused, which is revealed later in the book.
So she was afraid herself.
Right. She was afraid and afraid what would happen to her, afraid what would happen to her little girl. Mm-hmm. And she wasn't strong enough to face that.
Yeah. How many people out there, Kristen, do you think are simply afraid to make the phone calls we're talking about here?
What I do know is that sexual abuse and sexual assault is very underreported, which would let me know that lots of people are afraid and that that's a really normal experience and that that's part of the process.
Mm-hmm. Well, give me some reasons why you think it's so underreported.
I would say that one of the reasons is because with all the other crimes, it's really clear. A crime has happened and I am the victim here, and the other person is the quote-unquote bad guy. Mm-hmm. With sexual violence, grooming really throws in that piece of a relationship that feels so real, pardon me, and loving and caring. And victims also feel like, I don't like the sexual abuse that's happening, but I do like having a relationship with this person. And that makes it really confusing.
Mm-hmm. And so difficult to navigate then. Yeah.
I'm
wondering about your... Yeah, go ahead, Kathy.
Steve, I just wanted to add that as I have... I recently presented at a young authors conference, and I've been out talking to young people who've read the book, and it has really hit me strongly how much that teenagers feel that this topic needs to be discussed more in schools, that it's not talked about enough, that it's a big issue and that people know it's an issue, but they're not talking about it enough. And so one of the things that Say Something can do is help people open that dialogue because stories open the gates for people to discuss topics. I know Moxa also has a program they can present that can help people talk about it. But I did just want to emphasize we're not talking about this enough in our schools.
Why would that be, do you think? Is the topic just so sensitive that administrators and faculty and teachers just stay away from it?
Boy, I can't really answer that because that's going to be on a school-by-school basis. I do think most schools do offer something. They offer a discussion in health class or some kind of program. But what I'm hearing is that it's not enough, that we need more dialogue and more openness and not sort of that one time of the year maybe when that discussion occurs.
You know, that's interesting to me, Kristen, because my sense of this generation, this teenage generation we're talking about here, is they're so much more open to talking about problems that folks in my generation never wanted to deal with.
I think that's true, and that the youth generation right now has to talk to us, the adults. So maybe a lot of the work is on the part of the adult generation to make this more speakable and to bring up the conversations themselves.
Mm-hmm. Is that happening, do you think?
It's absolutely increasing in conversation and awareness, yeah.
What else should happen in terms of what to do if you've been abused, Kristen? What other steps need to be taken besides making the phone call? Or maybe that's the only thing you have to do.
Well, there are options. So if someone experiences a recent sexual assault, they absolutely can go to a local hospital. They absolutely can make a police report. They can tell any trusted adult that they feel comfortable with. A good starting place is to call a Moxa Crisis Line because that advocate who's there 24/7 can lay out those options and put that power with the survivor.
What do you do if a young person has approached you and spoken to you in confidence and has told you about a situation of sexual abuse? What does the adult do at that point in terms of responding to the call for help, but also wanting to respect the confidentiality of the person who told them?
Sure. I think that oftentimes when young people don't want the abuse disclosure to go any further, what they're really saying is, I want to feel safe. I want the adults around me to respond in an okay way. I want to feel okay in this process. So we can actually make the report as appropriate so we can keep kids safe while maintaining the security and comfort of that youth.
Explain that to me some more. I mean, are you saying that you can report something and not become aware of the name of the kid who's been abused?
If we make a report of child abuse, then the appropriate parties will know the name of that child. And we can ensure in that entire process that that child knows that they have done nothing wrong and that they did not deserve the abuse and that this isn't their fault. So while the reporting process can be one that has its struggles, we can meet those struggles with assurance to that child that you did nothing wrong and this isn't your fault.
Yeah. Tell me about the training some of your counselors actually go through and how they're made to be prepared for moments like this.
Sure. So all of MOXA staff and volunteers have extensive training in sexual violence and those dynamics, as well as appropriate response. Many of our staff have the credentialing to provide counseling and just a ton of experience with the survivors themselves. And that's where we get our greatest learning. Mm.
How big of a staff do you have?
About 75.
Mm-hmm. That's quite a staff.
It's a lot, yeah. And volunteers on top of that.
No kidding. Okay, our phone number here again, 816-235-2888, or you can tweet us at KCUR up to date. You wrote the book again because why, Kathy? Tell us what got you going on the book, because that's a pretty significant commitment of time.
Yes, well, when survivors started talking to me, their voices just lived inside my head. And I kept hearing their stories and that there was something that they wanted to say. And I felt that I could represent sort of their collective voice. And there were things that I wanted to address that I wanted to make available to people. Like in the work we do, stories help open discussion, mm-hmm. whether it's a business issue mm-hmm. or a sexual abuse issue. So the story provides a way for people to see, yes, it's important to know about reporting. It's also important to know that you have options for reclaiming your life that are separate from the reporting.
Tell me about that. Options for reclaiming your life, meaning what?
There are different types of counseling that are available. There are different therapists, and you find the therapist that fits you. You find the counseling that works for you. EMDR is one thing that's very good that helps your brain process the trauma of what happened so it is more manageable.
Right. Let's go to some calls here. Dodi from Kansas City, Missouri. Dodi, you're on Up Today. Good morning.
Yes. Hi, Steve, and thanks for this great conversation. I'm a competitive athlete, and I'm excited to share a very positive learning and experience called safesport.org that all of our athletes were required to complete an online 90-minute course before we could compete this year. So working through the sports systems is a great way to get increased awareness to all of us who love children and want them to have safe experiences as they grow up.
Okay. Are you familiar with that that group, Kristen?
Moxa, maybe. I personally am not. Thank you for sharing.
Yeah. I'm glad to know about it. Thanks very much, Dodi. Let's go to James from Kansas City, Missouri. James, good morning.
Good morning. My question is, how can I get some counseling and how can I receive that book that they are bringing up on the radio, please?
Hawkins, help James out.
Sure. There. For counseling, please call MOXA at 816-531-0233.
And the book is available wherever books are sold.
The book, again, is Say Something, James, and I'm glad you called in here. We're going to have to leave our good conversation there. The book, again, is called Say Something. Kathy Morrison is the author. We were joined by Kristen Mills Trowbridge with MOXA. That's the Metropolitan Organization to Counter Sexual Assault. Thank you both for a good conversation. I appreciate it.
Thank you for having us.
Monday on the show, Missouri State Senator Roy Blunt will be here. He'll give us his take on the Mueller report and explain what help there is for victims of the recent flooding. That's Monday on KCUR's Up to Date. Doctors tired of insurance restrictions are offering health care for a low monthly fee. Learn about direct primary care at kcur.org/up to date. Our theme music is composed by the great Bobby Watson. We had help this week from Linda Scher, Genevieve DeMarteau, Maria Carter, Danny Alexander, Luke Martin, Devin Davis, and Elizabeth Ruiz. I'm Steve Kraske, and you are up to date.